At the Table with Tony is brought to you by Trafe Hustlin. That's www.trafehustlin.com. Your home for all things barbecue.
Hello, my name is Gianluca Rotura, Rotura solo di cognome, and I represent In Vino Veritas with my family, author of Wine Made Easy, pizzaandcoffee.com, piazzalife.com, and you are listening to At the Table with Tony. I love your beautiful faces.
Welcome to At the Table with Tony. I'm your host, Anthony Scilia, but most of you know me as Tony Mangia. Come along with me as I visit the places, meet the people, and eat the food that make many communities in this great country Italian-American. Andiamo! On this episode of At the Table with Tony, we visit with my friend, Gianluca Rotura, at his wine shop, In Vino Veritas, on New York City's Upper East Side. We talk about growing up Italian in New York City, as well as how his family acquired the wine shop. And we also touch on his book, Wine Made Easy. So pour yourself a glass of wine, sit back, and enjoy the show. Welcome to At the Table with Tony. I am your host, Anthony Scilia, better known as Tony Mangia. And today we have a special treat for you. We are visiting with my friend Gianluca Rotura at his wine shop in Vino Veritas, located at 1375 First Avenue in New York City. Gianluca, thank you for opening your doors to us. Thank you for welcoming us into your home.
Thank you so much. My doors are always open for you guys.
I appreciate it. So let's talk a little bit about, obviously, you're Italian.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit
how
about...
How did you guess?
Gianluca Rotura, I think. That's
I'm Scandinavian.
Scandinavian. So let's start off by talking a little bit about you and your family.
Okay,
so
sure.
So where are you guys from in Italy? How did you get here to America? Stuff like that.
So I'll start with my father's side. First, both my parents are born and raised in Italy. And my father, he's actually from Calabria. Small, you know.
What's the town?
It's called Acquaro.
Okay.
I mean, there's, you know, there was like, at its height, there were maybe 2,000 people there.
Wow. So, yeah. Yes.
So, and, you know, I mean, up until 20 years ago, the donkey would come down in the morning. A guy on a donkey would come down in the morning and bring hot ricotta that they made. Yeah. Now they're fancy. They have a car. So he's from this small town in Calabria, and he grew up in a house that it's so awful to look at. He doesn't want, you know, he walks by it. He doesn't want to turn his head and look at it. But, you know, he was dirt poor, and he was born in the middle of World War II in one of the poorest regions in Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he grew up that way. And my mother on the other side is she's from Salerno, which is further north. I like to tell people I'm biracial. She's from further north, so I guess she would be a Polentone compared to my father, right? Yeah. So she's from Salerno, which is outside of Naples, and she grew up right after the war, actually. And
what was it? She's from Salerno.
Salerno, yeah, right next to the famous cemetery where the English soldiers are buried in Ponte Cagnano, yeah. And you know, she also grew up as poor, not as poor as my father. I mean, my father's breakfast, which happened to be mine, was bread and olive oil, you know, a little hot pepper. Anyway, so. She grew up a little, quote, richer because, you know, they had even more land than what my father did. So, but I always felt more connected to my mother's side because we could talk about this later. In the Italian household, there's this misconception about Italian culture. But actually, even though the Italian man is the man of the household, it's really the woman that runs the show. Just like the misconception of Catholicism, where, you know, women are very prominent after Jesus Christ. Mary is the most important figure. And in fact, I think you know this better than I do. Probably half the saints are all women.
Mm-hmm.
So people don't know this. So, and we could talk about this later, about the strength of Italy as a culture because of their family. It's all because of the woman. So really, I always identified more with the Salerno side of my background because, first of all, that's what she cooked. My father, you know. My mother didn't want him touching the kitchen because he made a mess. So when my mother would cook, I would eat Neapolitan cuisine. You know, for those interested, the cuisine in Italy gets defined by the largest city. In that case, it would be the capoluogo, the head province, which would be Naples in the Campania region. So I grew up that way. My father's dialect is Calabrese, which it's very hard to understand. And he spoke Italian proper, but my mother actually spoke Neapolitan dialect. So I identify with that. I have a much larger family on my mother's side. And they came from very poor beginnings. They had lands where they grew everything. They grew all the animals. I mean, you name it, cows, pigs, rabbits, chickens, all kinds of stuff. They would make their own honey. They would make their own wine. My grandfather was a winemaker. They made their own cheese. They made their own prosciutto. They made their own salumi. They made everything from scratch. The chairs they sat on and the tables they ate off of. So I was really lucky and blessed to have that kind of background. I got that full immersion in all these different aspects. And actually, though they were born in Italy, they ended up meeting here. You would like the story. They ended up meeting in Newark, New Jersey.
Newark.
And this, yeah, they actually got married in that. What's that famous church? It's in the chapel, that big church. You were there.
St. Gerard?
I forgot.
St. Lucy's Church?
It's a huge one in Newark. It's the biggest cathedral.
In the cathedral or in St. Louis? St. Lucy's was the big Italian church.
It's the biggest one in Newark, but it's a chapel in that. I got to find out.
Yeah. Wait, so when they first came to America, they settled in Newark?
No, my mother did. My father settled for like, I don't know, 6 months in somewhere in Queens. And then he came right to the city. And I, by the way, I grew up in Manhattan. So I had a different kind of Italian-American upbringing than the typical Italian-American. So it was different. It wasn't better or worse. It was just different.
It's different, yeah.
And but there's a funny story I would like to say. First of all, besides the fact that the priest who married my parents ended up getting married himself 2 weeks later or whatever. So that's a funny story, but this is going to be a fun hour. My father's grandfather left a family to come to America, you know? And they never heard from him. You know, maybe they got a letter, but at some point, I think he got remarried or whatever. When my father came to this country, and by the way, he came literally on a boat, not the expression like, oh, he's off the boat. He was literally off a boat. And, you know, one of his fellow travelers, yeah. Uh-huh. Well, I don't know if he was from Calabria, but one of the people there, he actually left from the port of Naples. One of his fellow travelers had to hide links of sausages, and he had it going up one arm around his neck and over the other arm, and he put a coat over it, you know? And by the way, they checked you for everything. It was embarrassing for my grandfather to watch my father look at him get dressed naked. You know, nowadays, forget about it. You got Ebola, no problem. Come right in. Back then, you couldn't come in if you had a cold.
Yeah.
So it was a different world. So anyway, my mother settled my father came here, and his brother came a few years earlier, and he said, "Listen, I finally found our grandfather. You want to go meet him?" He goes, "Yeah, no problem." He went to meet his grandfather, and there wasn't really much of a connection there. You know, he saw him a few more times, let it go, and that's it. Never really saw him again. He ended up dying, and that's it. There was no, familial connection.
Yeah, yeah.
So years later, my father was a hairdresser. I'll get to that in a second. But, you know, hairdressers, you're either, if you're a male hairdresser, you're either gay or you're a playboy. And he was a playboy. And he just loved going out with women and stuff like that. And he ended up meeting my mother at a party. And he was supposed to meet, actually, it's a funny story. There's a guy who owns a restaurant named Quattro Gatti. One of the owners was supposed to hook up with my mother, and my father was supposed to hook up with. Anyway, they ended up, my mother and father ended up hitting it off. And the next day, my father tells his brother, he said, "Listen, I met the girl I'm going to marry." He says, "You say that every you know?" It's kind of like Joe Pesci in Goodfellas. "I bring a nice girl home every night." So he goes, no, "You don't understand. This is like an old school kind of girl. I'm going to marry this girl. I have to get her." He goes, "Where was the party?" He goes, "I don't know. I got the address in the car. Let me go." He went to the car. He came back. He brought the address. And he goes, "Alberto," that's my father. He goes, "Alberto, are you sure you went in this apartment?" He goes, "Yeah, what are you talking about?" He goes, "That can't be the apartment." He goes, "Yeah, I was there last night. This is the apartment." He goes, "This is where our grandfather's apartment was."
No.
Yeah.
Wait a second. So they met the same place where your grandfather, where their grandfather lived.
Yep. And, you know, my father just brushed it off. He went to the apartment once, didn't think of anything. 10 years later, and that's where he met my mother. Yeah. And then they ended up getting married, and then they got married in Jersey, but then they moved to the city because my father was here. And then that's it.
So now, hold on one second. So your mom, when she came over, she settled with her family, or she came by herself?
She already had, I don't know, two or three sisters here, and her father was already here.
Okay.
So my mother's father, who, by the way, the land that they had, my mother's land, he made her buy her land as a teenager. It's an interesting story. I want to put that in. It's because that's the mindset that they come from. As a teenager, imagine telling a teenager now, work, save money, buy the land, and then work the land. So anyway, so that's the kind of person my grandfather was. He would stand in front of the TV and like pontificate if he didn't agree with what the news was telling him. Anyway, so he would... So he brought my mother over, and, you know, just like the Godfather, when they went on a date, I think the first date was at the Metropolitan Opera. Wow. I mean, the whole family had to come along.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, real old school.
Yeah.
Real
and
old school.
When my father would talk to my mother on the phone, my grandmother was on the other end listening. Yeah. But that's why my father loved it. He said, "Perfect. This is what I want."
Yeah. That won't fly nowadays.
No, forget it. Nowadays.
That wouldn't fly nowadays. Now you got to text people. You can't even talk on the phone. So, Gianluca, growing up, you must have spent a lot of time in Italy, right?
Yeah, a large portion of my life was spent in Italy. By the way, before I go further, as proud as I am about my Italian roots and background and everything, growing up in Manhattan, I was really lucky and blessed because I got to, you know, I was thinking about this last night, thinking about this interview. I got to hang out with, you know, I'll go eat Burmese food with you know, a Haitian friend, a Puerto Rican friend, and an Irish friend. So, I you know, one of my favorite cuisines is actually Vietnamese food. Mm-hmm. So even though I you see me on social media always talking about Italian food, it's only because I'd rather talk about what I'm most knowledgeable in.
Yes, yes.
I mean, I love everything, you know. I mean, I love all kinds of cultures and their foods. But, of course, when it comes to food, everybody, yeah, you know, I think it was Neil Simon, he said there's only two rules in the universe, the law of gravity, and everybody loves Italian food.
That sounds
which
about
is
right.
True.
That sounds about right.
So, yeah, so I spent a lot of time in Italy. I would probably say if I had to add it up, all the time I spent, you're talking about maybe 3 years of my life total was probably spent there, because I would often spend months at a time there. All, you know, growing up, if I would go there, my parents would just send me there for the whole summer. And I would go all over Italy because I was lucky enough to have my father in Calabria, my mother from near Salerno in the Amalfi Coast area. I would go there and spend time there. And, of course, I traveled to Rome and Sicily and everything. So I spent a lot of time there. I currently spend more time further north of Salerno near Naples in Sarno, from where my wife is from. We have an apartment there right in the heart of San Marzano. Which
Okay.
I would love to talk about the whole tomato situation there. You know, I'm sure you know. She's from a town called Sarno. In that area, right next to it is San Marzano.
Okay.
San Marzano, as you obviously are very well aware of, is known for their tomatoes.
Yeah.
Italy has many different types of tomatoes, but that happens to be the most famous one. And San Marzano, I mean, right now we're in my store on the Upper East Side. San Marzano, the whole area, it's like the size of the Upper East Side.
Okay, so it's really, really small.
Really small. There's no way that all these San Marzano tomatoes that people are seeing are actually San Marzano. It's mathematically impossible. And I remember I was at an event with my wife, Charles and Michelle Ciccolone, who you know, they're like, you know, the greatest wine and food couple anywhere. And I was explaining this very thing to them, and, you know, of course they knew it. And this guy behind me, I was telling them, you know, how it's impossible how there are this many real tomatoes. Because San Marzano is a variety, and it has to come from the growing areas.
From that area,
up,
yes,
you know, San Marzano.
Yes.
And they do extend it. It gets pretty large, but it's not just the town of San Marzano and Sarno and Nocera. It's pretty large, but it's still mathematically impossible. And this guy taps me on the shoulder. He goes, excuse me, I just need to tell you something. If it says San Marzano on the label, it has to be San Marzano. I'm like, yeah, and I got a bridge to sell you. You know?
Well, I mean, technically, yes, he's right, but he's wrong in the way that it's just like you said, it's mathematically
it's impossible. Yeah, yeah. And anyway, and in fact, actually, speaking of that, when you open a San Marzano can of tomatoes, you're lucky if when you open it, you'll take one out. You'll find one San Marzano and the rest
some
maybe Roma tomatoes or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And they could be great. You know, maybe they're grown in Puglia, which makes great tomatoes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
you know, but, you know, we can get into that whole discussion. So, yeah, so I spent my time there. I spent a lot of time in Italy, and I was really lucky because while my family had restaurants here, we can get into that later, I also had, you know, talk about the farm-to-table movement. I was really literally there watching my family.
Living it.
Living it, yeah, making cheese, making wine, showing me, you know, and I sucked at it. I'm not acting like I know what I'm doing, but I literally absorbed all this knowledge, and I would, you know, my cousin would take me fishing. He would dissect a fish. This is this, this is that. He would, you know, he would show me how to milk cows and stuff. And I had other cousins who had gelaterias and, you know, other cousins who had cafes and stuff. So it was really, looking back at it now for this interview, I was like, man, I was born to watch all this.
Yeah.
And actually, the next book I'll be writing will be incorporating all this stuff I have, because it's a unique situation. I feel blessed to have all this knowledge, and I love sharing it. And Italy is, as you know, it's jam-packed. Mm-hmm. Every corner is jam-packed with stuff. And I always felt that the Amalfi Coast area, the Naples area, the Campania area, which the Romans themselves would call Campania Felix, that's like the jackpot of especially culinarily speaking.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely,
you're
right,
you know? Of course, Sicily's great, Venice is great, but that, there's something, when people think of Italian food or what they think they know of Italian food, they're really thinking of Neapolitan food.
Because a lot of people that came to America were originally from that area. So
right.
even like technically macaroni and meatballs isn't like a true Italian dish. It's more of an Italian-American dish,
exactly.
But it still has its foundation and roots in this Campania region.
100%. And I would like to also add, because, you know, as you know, you're very knowledgeable with the stuff, that Italy is so different.
Oh, yeah.
And their languages are so different. Mm-hmm. There is no Italian cuisine, let's say.
It's regional.
And so are the dialects, so are the people, so are their dressing and everything. And one way that people were able to kind of unite, which is funny because a lot of Neapolitans don't want to unite with the rest of the, you know, they have a street in Naples. It's legally called Via Roma, but the original name was Via Toledo.
Oh,
from when the Spanish were there. And they still call it that. They don't want to call it that. They're not interested in, you know, in any kind of unification things. And the Neapolitan language is one of the most recognized dialects through the music.
Yes,
because they
dominated
music. They dominated opera.
Absolutely.
So a lot of times, maybe someone doesn't understand most of a Neapolitan language, but they'll pick up a few things because of that.
Through music.
Right. Yeah.
Through music.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, think about when the immigrants came here. They brought the food, obviously. They brought their religion. They brought their music.
Yeah.
And really, I mean, you think about all, especially there's singers like Jimmy Roselli and Connie Francis. Most of these singers, they are singing in a Neapolitan accent, Neapolitan dialect, which is amazing. It really is, because, like you said, that really was the epicenter of the culture of Italian culture in a way.
Well, yeah. Also, and you know, it was a major port city for all of its history. They weren't blocked off like mountain people or something, where they're just, this is what they have, which is great too, by the way, mountain culture. But there was constant evolving.
It was like New York before New York.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And Naples, a lot of people look down on Neapolitans. At one point in history, it was the most elegant city in Europe. They created a style of dressing, you know, and the only real schools of tailoring would be the English school and the Neapolitan school. There's also the Milanese school and the Roman school.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are the two powerhouses. And what they did, as you know, Neapolitans, like all Italians, but they exaggerate everything more. They love to gesticulate. They love to move. They actually took the suit and they took out the padding of the shoulder. So they deconstructed the suit to make it more comfortable.
That I didn't know.
Yeah. I have a blog and that I didn't update since my best friend died. But I wrote a whole article about me getting a custom-made suit and talking about, I'm actually deconstructing the suit piece by piece. And what the Neapolitans did. Anyway, they took out the shoulder padding. Because a lot of times the English, you know, God bless them, but they're very rigid.
Yeah, a little stiff, a little stiff. Yeah.
And it's reflected in their clothing. So while that is elegant, is it really elegant if you're like, well, hello, you're stuck. You know, you look like,
like the guards. Like the guards outside of the Royal Palace.
You got these like pilot shoulders sticking up. So they're all stiff and everything. And it's like, so that's not elegant because you don't look comfortable. So it's actually more elegant if you look comfortable and act comfortable and feel comfortable. So they deconstructed the suit. They took out the canvas and they took it all. And it's genius. To the untrained eye, it would look almost slightly disheveled, but there's an Italian word that, funny enough, non-Italians love more than Italians. It's called sprezzatura, and it's kind of, you know, the art of making something tough look, something hard, making it look easy, kind of. You know, and they're
Italians are good.
The kings of that. You know, especially Neapolitans.
Uh-huh.
You know, they can, in 2 seconds, they can whip something up.
Yeah.
So they have this thing, and I always saw a parallel. I tell people all the time, you got to go to Naples. The reason why, even though it's changing, it still retains its essence. And I tell people, Naples is like New York in the 80s. So I love to say New York is the capital of the world and Rome is the capital of history, but Naples is the capital of style. Milan's the capital of fashion. Naples is the capital of style. So you go there and you're feeling different. You feel just like New York did in the 80s.
Hmm.
And you still have craftsmen. You still have, I know a famous umbrella maker named Tallarico. He's still making umbrellas on his 85-year-old uncle on a bench that's like 200 years old.
That's amazing.
So they still have these people making, hand-making gloves and stuff. In its backwards way, because Italy, especially in the South, is very backwards. In their backwards way, they managed to retain something that you can't find anywhere. That, you know, the fact that it is lawless, the fact that it is that it didn't go with the times, is something that now people like us, you can go there and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe people are still doing this. You know, so I got to see those things. You know, when we were bored growing up, 20 minutes away from the Amalfi Coast, that's what we did. You know, and people who don't know the Amalfi Coast, I was privileged to get married there, and people who don't know the Amalfi Coast is considered like the most beautiful place in the world. It's this jewel, and they have all these little towns all around. And now it's full of tourists. You go to Positano, and you got, you know, during the high season, you pay $5 for an espresso. It's insane.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, you go there and you think, man, at some point, the only people here were people from Positano.
From the town.
Not even from other towns.
Yeah, just in that town.
Yeah, and that's it. And that's this is your beach, and this is where you hang out. And so I spent all my time there. As a side note, I was talking about other cultures. I also been to other great countries, Egypt, Jordan, Palestine, Israel, Turkey, Greece. I lived in France. You know, it's all great. But there's something about Italy. There's something about Italy that welcomes you. You know, there's something about going to Rome that you can be Chinese or Mexican, Peruvian or Irish. Wherever you are, you feel like you belong in Rome.
Yeah.
Because it's the cradle of civilization. And there's something welcoming about it. In France, I loved it. It was a jewel of a city. Maybe even nicer than any city in Italy, but I didn't feel welcome there. You know? That's, I think, what I learned the most about Italy is you know, even though it's changing there and they're becoming more westernized, I guess, and they're becoming a little more cold and a little more detached with social media, there still is this kind of warmth that you'll go there and someone you just met, you can end up having lunch with them.
That's a beautiful thing. And talking about lunch, let's talk a little bit about, let's kind of move forward.
Oh,
to...
by the way, I just want to say one thing. Spending, sorry if I can.
Yeah.
My first memory of Italy was in 1982 in Italy during the World Cup that Italy won.
Yeah.
So my first World Cup, I was going down the stairs. It was such an excitement that my aunt Zia Dolores would sew an Italy flag that we would wave off the balcony. And every morning I was so excited. I would go, Italia, 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 running down the stairs. When they won, the best player of that World Cup was Bruno Conti, who was he played the right winger. That's the position I ended up following in soccer. And he was the captain of Roma, and I became a Roma fan. And you see the Roma scarf in the window I have because of that. So that was that was my first moment in Italy, was watching them win the World Cup in Italy. Those are the memories I had of Italy.
So Gianluca, your family opened a successful Italian restaurant here in New York City called Sistina. So what was it like growing up in the restaurant business?
Growing up in the restaurant business, it's not as glamorous as people think, for sure. There's a dirty side to it. My friend Matteo told me it's something perfect. He said, if you're not crazy when you start the restaurant business, you'll be crazy by the end of it. It's the toughest business. I didn't say it's the toughest job. People always pick on me. Fireman is much tougher. Being in a war is much tougher. But it's definitely the toughest business. One thing goes wrong and everything will screw up. And I was a kid growing up. And, you know, that's why I have the views I have. It's because I grew up. My mother taught me how to do the books to a business of the restaurant. We had a restaurant. We had a hair salon, real estate. And so I would do the books for that as a kid. When I was a few years old, I was ready to... That's why I view things the way I view.
So hold on. Let's pause one second. So your family had a restaurant?
Yeah. I can actually tell you to lead into the restaurant.
Uh-huh.
So my father, who I told you was really poor, grew up with nothing, came on a boat. His main job is he's a hairdresser. But he's not just a hairdresser. And I don't mean this in a bragging way. I mean this in a laudatory, admiring way. He happens to be one of the world's most important hairdressers. And, you know, growing up, people were like, oh, I got my hair cut by Will Smith and, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow's hairdresser. And I'm like, well, the guy who writes them the checks goes to my father. So I'm talking about, like, the world's CEOs, billionaires, presidents, prime ministers, you name it, he got it there, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was Judy Garland's personal hairdresser for
wow.
2 years. Right, yeah. And by the way, my father, people to this day, they just came out the Judy Garland movie. To this day, they come to him. They say, can you give us dirt? Bloomberg is running for president. They hound my father all the time. He cuts his hair. He's mostly a women's hairdresser, but
he cuts
a few men. Please tell us about Bloomberg, whatever. Anyway, they actually misquoted him in a Bloomberg article 12 years ago in the New York Times. But anyway, about something. So he doesn't mention all his clients. Like, even to this day, I find out who his clients are. I'm like, wow, I didn't know that. But he had this brilliant idea that let me open up a non-competing business. I have all these rich clients. They swear by my father. They treat him like gold. And he said, let me just open up a restaurant. And he was smart enough to make it non-competing. And my cousins on the other side, on my mother's side, were deep in the restaurant business. And, I mean, they're like at the top of their other restaurant game. So it was like a perfect timing. And he made them partners. You know, they're so deep in the restaurant business that it's like, I'm sure you heard of this, you know, Sergio Maccioni and those people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're like on that level. They've been doing it. They've been doing this for 50 years. My cousin, he was the first person to bring colatura into the country almost, you know, 50 years ago. So
what explain colatura.
So colatura, it was even unknown outside of certain towns of the Amalfi Coast, mostly Cetara. It's Salerno, the Salerno area is known for their anchovies. So what they do in these towns is they take the anchovies, they decapitate them, eviscerate them, and they put them in a wooden barrel. They put a layer of salt. They put a circular row of the anchovies, you know, tail to head, put salt, put anchovies, put salt. Then they put a lid on it, put a stone on it. The stone, with the weight of the stone, presses down. The juices, I know it sounds disgusting, but the juices go all the way up. And then at the bottom of the barrel, they will poke a hole. Because there's a hole, the juices now go all the way down, filtering through the anchovies, so they're re-picking up all the flavors. And they drip out of the hole. Colata means to drip in Italian. And they drip into a glass jar. Then they take this glass jar and they put it out in the sun to help evaporate it, which helps concentrate it. And they use this thing to anoint. So it's like an anchovy juice, and they anoint foods with it. And people talk about a word, you know, umami, and that kind of salty, concentrated flavor. And a lot of people who ate anchovies, you can sneak it in their dish. They won't even know, and they love it. So you can make pasta aglio olio. You just throw this in, and it changes everything. And in fact, there's a chef who became famous for it, even though it's been around for hundreds of years, Pasquale Torrente, who's always at doing
yes,
events.
Yes.
I went to his restaurant. Exceptional, by the way. Anyway, so my cousin Antonio, he was the first person who did it, you know, in the 70s. And my other cousin Gerardo, who's also a great chef in Italy, he would give me this colatura. It's going back, you know, 25 years ago. He's like, "No, here, bring it in." And I would be so scared when I snuck it in my luggage that it would break, because then my clothes, forget it.
It would smell like...
you know, the Sashri Seaport used to smell like. Which, by the way, you know, you remember how it used to smell, the Seaport?
Yeah.
I think the reason why it smelled that way is because, not because of the fish, but because they were using wood. And it would soak into the wood. And then you never get it out.
Yeah, that's a good
point.
That's
why you should always have stainless steel. Yeah, now you go down to the Seaport, it doesn't smell that really anymore. And
yeah,
it's very expensive.
Totally different. Totally different from the 80s.
There you go, yeah. So then my cousins were there, and, you know, you walk in, you have my father, who's a very elegant, gracious guy. You know, most of the customers just saw him during the day, got their haircut, or that week. They go in, he's there greeting you. You have my cousin Giuseppe, who's floating around, causing this great floating experience. You have his brother, who's his polar opposite, Gerardo, who's just foreseeing all the operations. You have my other cousin Cosimo, who was there running the bar. He was a young, good-looking, muscular guy. You know, he was 18 years old. And he was keeping it lively. And in the back is where the magic happened. My cousin, Antonio, who's, you know, rest in peace, and his father, sorry, I get emotional.
Yeah.
Anyway, Antonio, he was my cousin, and he would always teach me. He would, you know, open up a fish, teach my brother. He's like, "Look at this. This is why the fish is this way. Show me how to butcher an animal." I know that sounds like a weird child upbringing, but, you know, you're like, "Oh, this is what you do in this. This is why the broccoli is this way. This is why, you know." And here I am, some kid getting free lessons, you know, way before the days of, you know, social media influencers.
Yeah,
you know?
Before the Food Network.
Yeah, before any of that. Yeah. And here I am. So that, you know, all this magic happened. And where else would you? What restaurant has? What is that? Four? What is that? Six different people in a family, all at the top of their game, serving you of this amazing experience that, you know, I remember the teachers, they didn't like me when they found out it was my father's restaurant. They're like, "Oh, hey, you're doing really great. Hey, can you get me a reservation there?" You know? I was like 6 years old.
Is the restaurant still there?
It's still there. It was originally in 81st and 2nd, but now my cousin, Giuseppe, he's really a futuristic kind of guy. He's always taking things to the next level. He moved it to 81st between 5th and Madison. And you walk in. They have other restaurants. They have San Pietro, where Gerardo and Antonio were, and Cosimo were there. And then Antonio died. But then they opened up Caravaggio also. So all those three restaurants, they're all between 5th and Madison on different blocks. Sistina moved to 81st Street between 5th and Madison. And it looks like Bruce Wayne's mansion. By the way, you need 2 credit cards for all of them. Yeah. So if you go, you should definitely go. But, you know, prepare to go in debt. But it looks like something out of a movie. And you know it's a different experience. And the food is it's unbelievable. It's only the very best of everything. And they're all really great restaurants. But, yeah, growing up in the restaurant business, I mean, a lot of my New Year's Eve parties were spent as a kid there with all these actors and celebrities, which is one of the reasons why I don't like many actors or celebrities, because I get to see how they really act. And I'm a kid. I'm like, "Man, these people are disgusting." Some, not all of them, some of them. But, you know, I remember a funny story. I used to love Robert De Niro, and my father had called me. He's like, "Oh, De Niro's here." And I was like, "Oh, my God." So I got dressed. I went there, and he was with John Cleese. And he got a call and then he had to leave. And I was so angry. But then he signed the menu. He's like, oh, to Gianluca. He misspelled my name with two C's, but that's okay. But then he went back. I actually got to meet him. And like I said, I don't care a lot of celebrities, but him, I idolized him, as I'm sure you did.
Yeah,
Al Pacino and stuff. And I said, you know, my dream is to star in a movie with you. He put his arm around me. He goes, how old are you? And then I was like 13. I was like 13. He goes, yeah, well, one day. And I'm so stupid. I still live with that like that. Like, well, maybe one day. I'm 41 now. And you know, there's a funny story. He would use it as his person, because Sistina was never open for lunch. So he would use it for lunch because he doesn't like to be around people.
Yeah.
I'm only sharing this because this is common knowledge. And he had a dinner. He had a lunch. And he said, told my cousin, he said, listen, I'm expecting a friend to come. So someone comes in and the light's shining in. So my cousin couldn't see who it was. And it was a guy who was dressed kind of disheveled. So my cousin goes, oh, no, please, get out of here. So he's like, the guy's like, no, I'm here to meet someone. He goes, no, come on, listen, please, get out. So De Niro goes, no, he's with me. Come on, he's with me. So my cousin's like, are you sure? He goes, yeah. So they sit down, whatever. So my cousin goes to get food. He comes out. Who was it? It was Al Pacino. Because
really?
I don't know if you know Al Pacino, like when he goes out, he's dressed in pajamas and stuff. So, and another story was De Niro, my cousin wasn't there. My mother was there. My mother, by the way, all the businesses, I have to mention this, all the businesses, none of them would have ever taken off the ground or been what they were if it wasn't for my mother. She has everything down to the, like again, the Italian woman. I remember back to that. If it wasn't for the Italian woman, my mother, like Sonny said to Michael Corleone, they would walk out with you-know-what in their hands. Nobody, none of them, my father wouldn't have anything. My father was spending all his money. My cousins too. They were very successful, but my mother organized everything, so every penny was accounted for. She can tell you the date on the penny. So she was there doing the books, and De Niro walks in. He's like, "Where's Giuseppe?" He's like, "Oh, he's not here." He's like, "Well, I gotta eat." So my mother's like, "Okay." So they go into the freezer, and De Niro's like, "Okay, well, what about this? My mother's like, "Well, you want me to? All right." So my mother was. Then my cousin came, and he ended up making it for him. But that's the kind of restaurant it was, because my cousin's very fixated on forming these relationships with his customers. And that's how I grew up, getting to watch this. Again, I didn't do anything. I was just hanging out, you know? My father worked 100 hours a week.
That's amazing.
We can't even contemplate just saying, forget it, just let someone else do it.
No, you had to be there. You had to be there, hands-on.
So I grew up with that mentality where it's like, you know, you scrub the dishes. I used to help wash the dishes during the day. I didn't have to do it. It's just the way it was. And so that is a school. Of course, by the way, my parents, they're going to hear this interview, and they're going to be like, what? He's lazy. they think, like, you know, anybody born after them and in America, you're lazy. It doesn't matter how much. I'm open 7 days a week. And they're like, come on, don't complain.
We're talking a lot about family.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think family is such an important aspect of who we are as Italians or Italian-Americans?
So, great question. By the way, thanks for doing this interview. I'm glad. I haven't seen you in so long. It's great. Yeah. So I'm glad. So family is very important. One of the reasons why Italy has been so successful as a country, if you can call it a country, and as a grouping of various cultures, is because of family. Interestingly enough, there still is an admiration, even from people who hated him, of Mussolini in Italy. He tried to liquidate all people's wedding rings, gold rings. He said, do it for the state. Now, I'm sure he probably advocated more being more pro-family. But if you look what's happened globally and what's happened throughout history, people, the state always tried to dissolve the family so they can control. But the reason why Italy went ahead is because of this loose grouping of families, loose grouping of city-states, but within the city-states and within these regions, and I guess kingdoms, let me be fair, were these families. And it all started in the home. And that's why these traditions were passed on. You're not going to pass it on through government or through a state or through a president or whoever or through Congress. It's not going to happen. And that's why Italy has been losing its soul in the past 20 years, is because this dissolution of the family. And my father, who did work 100 hours a week, no matter what, we had to be home for dinner. Unless it was for soccer, taekwondo, or school, there was no exception. We had to be home. And he would eat early at 5 o'clock just so he would wake up at 4:30 in the morning. He did this for his family. Wake up at 4:30 in the morning, no alarm clock, by the way, still to this day. He's 70, going to be 78 this year. Still wakes up, no alarm clock, went to work, 6 in the morning, came home at 5 o'clock, ate with us for an hour and a half, and then went to work, okay? And then he had Sunday mornings off, which we always spent together, because that's how Italians get by. You know, right now I'm so mad at myself because this job, my wife and I talk about it. I don't get to eat as much as I can with my family as I like to. I really hate it, and I don't want to be like, I hate for saying this, other types of families. To me, that's important. And the kitchen, that's where everything happened. You know, Italians have rooms in the house that no one ever touches. Right?
Yeah,
to have living rooms, you do not live in a living room. No. Right?
Plastic on the couch.
Yeah. And then like the dining room, there's a dining room, but you don't touch it. You don't dine in the dining room. You dine in the kitchen. You actually live it. Again, going back to the way the English were all kind of stiff, the Neapolitans are living it. You know, you actually have to, that's where the beauty, you know, the perfection is in the imperfections. It's in the nitty gritty. And that's what kept the families together. And it's kept together, again, as you know better than everybody, is that it's kept together through food.
Amen.
And that's another reason why Italian food is, forget about qualitatively, quantitatively. I know you're not allowed to say anything absolute anymore, but quantitatively, it's not even close. If you were to make the list of Italian foods, take the next, whoever's second place, it's a galaxies away, right?
Absolutely.
You're not allowed to say that because no one's allowed to be, you know, number one anymore.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's better. I will say it's better, but I'm not saying it's better. But at least quantitatively, can we at least admit that? And you know, Italians have more ways to prepare eggplants than most people have dishes.
Yeah.
Because they're just so focused on that. And one of the reasons they're so focused on that is because of family. You know, and yes, we're crazy, and yes, we fight amongst ourselves. And yes, Italian people love to not talk to each other. Every Italian family has people who don't talk to each other, by the way.
Oh,
you know?
That goes without saying.
You know? No, I don't talk to him. And, you know, they'll even sit at the same table and they won't talk to each other, which is so stupid. But, yeah, Italian family has kept that together. And historically, the religion has been a big thing. And, I'm not saying I'm this big shining example of Catholicism, but I do think that Catholicism did help Italy progress. You know, I know we're trying to have light, L-I-T-E, versions of Catholicism. You know, meatless Mondays is really just the Catholic Church is not eating meat on Fridays.
Yeah.
You know, you're not fooling me, you know? That's all it is.
Yeah.
You know, so everything is, it's just like, you know, vegans want to prepare kind of fake food to look like meat. You know, dump all over meat and then do your fake version of it. Just don't dump all over the Catholic Church's meatless Fridays and then you do your meatless Mondays. You know, but
that's a good point.
So it is very important, and I guess in the Italian Americans thing is you know the Sunday dinner. In Italy, it's the Sunday kind of lunch because in Italy they eat earlier. But there has to be some time dedicated to the family, because on that note, I will say Italians can be suffocating, especially Southern Italians. I mean, I go there and after a while, I'm like, yeah, man, I gotta get out. I have to do my own thing. I gotta go, you know. And so there is a herd mentality too. By the way, I will say. To be fair, I do want to talk about the negatives of Italy. I don't want to sit here and say Italy's the best all the time.
So now we are sitting in Vino Veritas. This is your wine shop here on First Avenue in New York City. So let's talk a little bit. So your dad had the restaurants with your cousins and your uncles.
And then, yeah, he left in 95.
So he left the restaurant business to open in Vino Veritas.
So right, yeah. My father's also involved in real estate. And in one of his buildings, he happens to have a wine store. Again, let me reiterate, my father worked 100 hours for this. Because I know there's this like almost like a bad thing if you have things in this world. But so there was a wine store. It was the first one in Manhattan after Prohibition. And I think there were only a few owners before us. So the people who were his tenants, really nice family, they were going to retire. And he says, let me take it over. So at that point, I was 18. My brother was 22. I was in college. And he said, let me open it up. But it was a shabby-looking liquor store. There were only maybe a few nice stores before us, but nothing like this. And I'm not bragging, but this is a pretty nice-looking store that my father designed. People are like, oh, my God, who's the interior decorator? Nothing. It's my father who grew, you know, the guy who once a year, you know, when the Feast of San Rocco came, he had ice cream. That was his treat. That's who the interior decorator. By the way, and The Godfather too. When they have the Feast of San Rocco, it's supposed to be August 16th. It's freezing and they're wearing coats.
That's a good.
So it's actually not. I don't know. It's got to be a reason, unless they made a big mistake. So that's what the interior decorator is. And actually, people will come in, and I can show you not just wine stores but businesses. that if they're still open, that copied, because we opened in 97, piece by piece, everything. And I couldn't believe they would come in, they'd take pictures, they'd ask questions, where did you get this? Who's the person? Can I have the number? And we were like the first wine boutique. There were maybe like five stores that were somewhat nice. So my father said, I want to do a Italian boutique to look at this way. He designed the whole thing. The stained glass is original from the 1800s. They actually painted it black. And they put an ugly neon sign over it.
Oh, so the stained glass was painted?
Covered. We only thought it was just that. And then we're like, wait a minute, really? It was all that. Yeah. And I think the same people who did work on Grand Central when they restored it did this.
Wow.
So we had to re-let it. And everything except where it says 1375 is all original. Unless they lied to us and just, you know, who knows. But but definitely we unearthed it. And that, I was telling you guys before we did the podcast, that sign, we have a sign that says, we deliver Butterfield 8. The telephone exchange was Butterfield 8. BU on the phone is 2-8. You would use the first two letters of the name, Butterfield, and the rest of the numbers. To call, you would call the operator and say, give me Butterfield 8 0100 or 0177. That's still our number today. So it's an historic sign that we kept. And what we did is we wanted to specialize not just in Italian wines, but in smaller family wines. Because, again, it's all about family. And we wanted to build these relationships with the families. We visited them in their wineries. We stayed there. We have dinner with them. They come here. We have dinner with them. Welcome them in our homes. When we select our wines, based on what my mother was cooking. I can guarantee you no wine store is doing that. Guarantee you. If they're trying the wine with food, I can guarantee you they're who knows, maybe they'll have a hamburger or something. There's nothing wrong with that, but I'm only going to have, let's say if I have a Matriciana for dinner, I'm going to have it with a Montepulciano. I'm not going to have it with a California Merlot or something.
Okay.
So we find two areas. So we really want to get to know the wine's personality because each wine from each vintage is different. And we get to know the people who make it. So we really started this thing, and then it exploded. This is going back 20, almost 25 years ago. And one after the other started opening up. Then, you know, what happens in New York happens in America, then happens all over the world. So I would like to think, not in a bragging way, but I would like to think that my father and me and my brother, who's the one who does the whole selection, he's got a nose. It's unbelievable. He knows exactly which wines to pick. And he's the one who selected and curated our collection. And, you know, back then, 25 years ago, it was like getting blood out of a stone to get people to buy rosé. Now people buy rosé. People demand rosé.
Why do you say that?
Because people are like, what is this? What, this pink? This is insane. This can't be. And then maybe the closest they would associate it with is white Zinfandel, which is kind of sweet, you know. So it was really hard to get people. New Zealand, we could not get people to buy New Zealand. We had a wine in the 90s that was great. No one wanted it. And the same people who were like, nah, I'm not buying wine from New Zealand. New York Times, whatever, write an article about it. They would come back. Oh, I have to have this wine. So, you know, we were proud to be one of the first people, definitely probably the first people, the retail, to have Gragnano, which is a red sparkling wine that you have with pizza, to sell that anywhere probably outside Gragnano. There's only maybe two restaurants that had it in the city before us. Gragnano's a red sparkling wine. People, you know, introducing that. What do you mean red sparkling? That's, I never heard. Wait, you have this with pizza? You know, so we love that. We love telling people stories because, again, just like Sestina, where else are you going to have that? Where else are you going to have somebody whose family actually makes wine, who the people who select the wine actually know the winemakers, actually know what we're talking about culinarily, and we can pair it with food. And, you know, we have the restaurant business to back it up, and I wrote a book on wine. So, you know, we really feel that we love this city so much. I don't know how much longer we can keep doing this. But we love this city so much that this is what made New York great. Because our version of what we do in the wine store, there was a butcher shop that did the same thing. There was a button store that did the same thing. New York used to be this great place. So we're trying for as long as we can to be here because we really enjoy, you know, 99% of our customers are really the nicest people you ever met. And we love nothing more than them giving us feedback about this wine and then saying, oh, I want to try something different.
So, Gianluca, you mentioned that you recently have written a book about wine called Wine Made Easy.
Yes.
So why did
you republished?
Okay, so why did you decide to write the book in the first place?
So in 2002, I'm the kind of person that once I get an idea, I get really fixated on it, and I just have to do it until I'm finished. And in 2002, during the busy season, during Christmas and New Year's, I don't know why I said them, and I was helping customers out, and I would run to the back anytime I had an idea, and I would write it down. And then at nighttime, I would come here till 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, whatever, and do the book. And I was really dedicated. And I wrote the book in 4 weeks. I don't know how the hell I began again because I was so focused. I was driven. I wasn't inspired or motivated. I was driven. I said, I got to get this done. And I got to be honest, I love doing it because I love explaining things I care about to people. But subconsciously, I realized that I probably also did it to learn it better myself. Because I really feel that when you write things down, you see it differently. And you're like, oh, you know, I knew about a wine already, but it's amazing. I made myself learn more about it as I was writing it because I had to think about it in a certain type of format. And as you know, you got the book, and thank you for sharing it on your social media. I wrote it in like a school workbook look. Most wine books that you buy are very confusing. Some of them are very boring. I read them and I'm like, oh man, this is too much. Even though I know what they're talking about, I'm like, this is you're losing me. You're losing me.
Yeah.
So most people they just want to know 1, 2, and 3. So the best way to present it, I also used to teach Taekwondo. So I know how to like explain a certain concept. I'm like, you know, so I took one. I'm like, let me break it down. You know, most people really appreciate it. A few people thought it was, oh, this looks, you know, this book looks too shoddy kind of, but I don't care. I want people to not be afraid of my book. So if I have to, quote, lower myself to, you know, make people feel comfortable, so be it. I know who I am. I don't care. So I wrote this book. It came out in 2004. I wrote it when in 2002. I was 24. 2004, I was 26. It came out. It was great. I self-published it. I sold a lot of copies. And then all of a sudden, the company went out of business. They owed me money. They owed their other authors money. And I didn't care about the money, but I didn't have a book. I come to find out later that some of the books that they were selling to people, they were scrambling my information. So they were putting red wines in the white wine section. Oh, yeah, so I'll forget about it. I had to actually edit the book on the phone. I had to tell them, can you move it over 2 spaces? Can you move over Valpolicella to the left? I mean, it was going back 20 years ago. I was embarrassed looking back at it now. So again, because I'm working on my second book, I said, I have to republish that book because it was a rock in my shoe for 10 years. I don't have a book. So I republished it and I added more countries because back then I only added the countries people would have been familiar with. So now I added more. I added Georgia. I added Hungary and stuff. And it's a straightforward book. And it's the way I talk about wine in the book is straightforward. Sometimes they're not even full sentences. They're just right to the point. And that's the way we recommend wine. The way we recommend wine in this store is people come in, we acknowledge them, we have a policy here, we always say, we greet them, and then we leave them alone because you don't want to be bothered. And then after about a minute, we say, hey, you know, do you need any help? Are you looking for anything particular? And if they say yes, you know, it usually goes something like this. They say, oh, you know, I'm looking for a wine. Okay. And is it for food or just for drinking? Personally, I prefer you drink wine with food. But, you know, I understand people have for all occasions. And if they say it's for food, I say, okay, well, what are you eating? And then maybe they'll be like, oh, I'm eating, you know, pasta with bolognese sauce, whatever. Okay. Or maybe they're saying I'm eating something that can go with both white or red. And I say, well, you know, would you like white or red? Oh, I'm in the mood for red. Good. Okay. Around how much are you looking to spend? Oh, 10 to 15. Cool. What do you like and don't like? I think it's very important that people know what they like and don't like and why they don't like it. Or like it. And then they tell me, they say, you know, I don't like when a wine is very, and sometimes I see them struggling for it. So I have to kind of coax it out of them. And even if they're using the wrong description, I know what they mean. And I say, okay, you know, they say, I definitely don't like something that's too, whatever, spicy or whatever. And I say, and then I give them the options. I said, these are the wines. And then I love to tell them the stories about the wines. And I said, you know, this is a great wine. It comes from Vittoria in Sicily, which is southeast, blah, blah, blah. The winemakers, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and I'll tell them about the soils. and why the soils make a certain wine a certain way. If I have a personal story, I love to inject my personal story. I've been to Vittoria. It's beautiful. And, you know, and then I said, please come back, tell us how you like it. And they come back, and they're very, they love it because, we, you know, we really fine-tune it to the occasion. If it's not for food or if it is for food, what kind of food? So that's, those are the steps that we take to recommend wine.
So Gianluca, obviously, I recommend people come to visit you here in Vino Veritas.
Yes, definitely.
But if they're in California, if they're in Toledo, Ohio, if there's someplace else where they can't get to your store, can you give them, those people, some tips and tricks on how to look for a good wine?
Yeah, sure. Well, the most important thing is obviously if you can find a good wine store, whether that be online or retail, and of course find one where there's a knowledgeable staff. I hate to say it, but if you pick up my book, Wine Made Easy, I think you'll get, you'll, but I have to say, yes, you can pick up my wine, my book, Wine Made Easy. But if you don't try wine, I'm not trying to turn you into an alcoholic, but if you don't try it, you're, a lot of it, you're not going to really understand, because again, it's what do you like and why do you like it? Because you have to know why you don't like something. That's more important than why you like something. Yeah, if something tastes great, great. That's, you know. But now I have to figure out what I don't like. You know, when me and my brother, especially my brother, we try wines. Unlike high-end restaurants where the sommelier only is presented with the best wines, we try insane amounts of junk. Thank God. Mm-hmm. So we can relate to it. So if I find an $11 bottle of wine in New York, I know every state's different, but in New York City, $11, it's hard to get something good. So if I try an $11 wine that's good, believe me, it's going to be good at that price. It's going to far blow out anything else because I tried all the junk. But that's because what am I comparing it to? Relative to what? And at what price? So I have an idea. I'm putting things into context and perspective. So what I think, what I would tell people is try different wines from different countries. You might absolutely hate Italian wines. You might absolutely love it. What I would do is pick a budget. Whatever, 10 to 15, which for us, that's a very common, you know, thing. And you should be able to get a good wine for that. And start working your way around it. Unfortunately, for certain wines and for certain grapes from certain places, you will have to spend more than that, you know, but a lot, make an allotment, you know, budget yourself out. And hit up the main categories. For instance, everyone has heard of Bordeaux. Definitely should try Bordeaux. Go in, get a $10 to $15 bottle of Bordeaux. Try to have, especially European wines, try to have them with meals because they're really meant for meal. Wine is supposed to go with food. It's only lately more of an American thing to have it on its own. And I don't mind that. Sometimes, you know, I love, especially on a hot summer day, we, you know, have a Riesling or a Gruner or Vino Verde. It's great. But try to have it with food because it really, they really bring the characteristics out of each other. So you have a Bordeaux. Bordeaux is great with red meat. So make yourself whatever, steak with Chateaubriand with the Bernaise sauce, which for some reason French restaurants don't do anymore. I love it. I don't know why it's not cool. Maybe it's going to be cool again. And then have it. And you know what? You might be like, I don't like it. Or I don't like it, but I see why it goes. I see it. You have to visualize it. You have to say, look, I'm tasting wine. Is it light-bodied? Is it medium-bodied? Is it full-bodied? What is light body? Light bodied is like water. You drink water, this is light. A milkshake is heavy bodied. How it feels in the mouth. It's heavy, it's creamy, it's rich, it's round. Crisp. Lemonade is crisp. A milkshake is round. It's kind of, you know, California Chardonnays, which I have always despised. That's my personal thing. That's what they taste like. They're very round and buttery and rich and just, it's like, it's just too much. I prefer wines with higher acidity, which makes wines crisp. So figure that out. You have to be like, man, I really don't like light-bodied wines. Your tolerance for sweetness and fruitiness. This is very important. The only people who like, quote, sweet wines are wine novices or wine experts. When I say, quote, it's not really sweet. Most wines are vinified dry, unless they're dessert wines. So when you're drinking a wine, it depends on the amount of residual sugar. A wine novice will prefer something that's very fruity. You know, kind of like a beer novice. They're not going to like Guinness. They're going to be like, oh, this tastes like tire juice. They're going to want something kind of easy drinking. But the more you drink wine, you're going to want, the more you drink beer, you're going to think, hey, this Guinness is pretty good. Riesling, for instance. I'm sure, have you ever heard of Riesling?
Yeah, oh,
it's
of course, yeah, yeah.
It's a grape.
Yeah,
yeah. It's a genetically superior grape because it has high levels of sugar and high levels of acidity, which balance each other out. Usually in grapes, you don't get that. You lose one and you get the other. So a wine novice will love Riesling. But then as they start drinking more wine, they're going to say, oh, no, sweetness is like a wine cooler. Well, yes, wine coolers are sweet, but sweetness is different than being sweet. And a Riesling has sweetness to it. So if you get like a Cabernet Riesling, for instance, which is the first level where they pick the grape, so it doesn't have that much residual sugar, you're drinking it and you're going to realize, man, this pairs really well with so many different types of foods. So you have to understand what your tolerances are, and you have to pair it with food. And I would hit all the basics. What are the basics? Let's start with California, America. You would do California, Cabernet. California, Zinfandel. For Pinot Noir, I would go to Oregon. For Merlot, if you must, I would go to Washington State. Sauvignon Blanc, you get great inexpensive ones from New Zealand. You can get... If you want Spanish, you have to try a Rioja. I mean, these are the bare basics. If you want French, you have to try Bordeaux. You have to try Red Burgundy. Red Burgundy, if you want a good one, I hate to say it, below than 20, it's almost impossible. It's a very hard to deal with grape. So to really coax out that beautiful nature, you ever see the movie Sideways?
Oh, yeah.
He loves Pinot Noir. Actually, what he says about Pinot Noir, it's true. It doesn't grow everywhere. It's hard to deal with. But if you can do it right, and it's going to cost you, it's very good. It's I don't know if the ethereal is the word I'm looking for, but you have to try Côte du Rhône. And then if you have the money, work your way up to Châteauneuf-du-Pape. I love that wine. For Italian wines, Italians, just like with food, forget about qualitatively. Quantitatively, there's not even close. There's over 2,000 grapes if you include the clones. Not all of them are meant to make wine, but the next close is France, and that's like millions of miles away. So you really hit the jackpot with Italian wines. You have to try Chianti, definitely. You have to try Barolo and or Barbaresco. Those are very expensive, so what I recommend you do, get a Nebbiolo. Barolo and Barbaresco are made with a grape called Nebbiolo, and you can get a great one for $20. You have to try Valpolicella, Barbera, Dolcetto. Go down to Campania, you can try Aglianico. You can try, from Sicily, Nero d'Avola. You can try Pinot Grigio, I'm sure you tried it. But so you can try more interesting whites, Greco, Falanghina, Fiano. You can try Kerner, which is actually a great grape, which is a cross made from a genetic cross of Riesling and a red grape called Schiava. So the options are limitless. Take them all, try them, dedicate time and money and I guess patience, and write down so you remember, yeah, this wine tasted that way. Even if your terms are wrong, it doesn't matter. Just, I found this wine to have notes of gooseberry. Fine, write it down. And then you'd be like, I love wines that have gooseberry. Well, then you like Sauvignon Blanc-based wines. One of the famous notes of Sauvignon Blanc in the wine world is that it smells like cat piss. And in fact, right here, I made my friend do this. My friend had a cat that used to use a toilet, and I made him do a Photoshop of his cat urinating into the toilet, and it has a quote that says, I love Sauvignon Blanc. I think I shared it on my store's Facebook. So, again, you might love it, you might hate it, but you have to try it out. You're not going to know. You're not going to know if you don't like pork belly if you don't try it. So that's what I would recommend. And again, buy wine made easy. I don't know what else to say.
So, Gianluca, you are pretty active on social media and blogging. Tell us I know you have two blogs, right? So one is pizzaandcoffee.com and the other one is piazzalife.com.
Yes.
So kind of talk to what are these blogs about?
So in 2007, again, I got fixated on an idea. I'm like, man, what is it? And this is right before the Neapolitan pizza explosion, which I can get to in a second. What is it about pizza that people... Again, it's like they need to, I'm better than you, I'm better than you, I'm better than you, I'm better than you, And it's kind of this, like, I want to outdo you. And I'm like, man. But I realize, and I'm looking into the backgrounds of some people, I'm like, I don't know if these people know what they're talking about. And I'm like, did they just come from interviewing God? What is this arrogance, right? So again, I only want to talk about stuff if, because stuff I know. I don't talk about lacrosse. I don't talk about, you know, golf. I know nothing about that. You can tell me that to be the best golfer, you have to paint your face blue. I'll believe it. I don't know. But this stuff, I'm like, man, I got to write something. So in 2008, I finally put it out called Pizza and Coffee, because coffee is also something that people want to talk about, and especially espresso. So I just, it's basically just a rant. Some people hated me for it. I don't care. So I wrote about it, and I really took it from the Neapolitan perspective. I love New York pizza. There used to be an expression, Arthur Schwartz, who's a great, great guy, great author. He wrote it in one of his books that in New York, it used to be, and this is true, that if you don't eat, if you're not near the pizza you love the pizza you're near. And it's true. That's the way it was, man. Nowadays, my God, you walk in, you're like, oh, I mean, it's like Godzilla took something out of his intestines. I don't know what it is. It's disgusting. And
it's 99 cent pizza.
Yeah. And people eat it. And by the way, Domino's is opening 1,000 locations in Italy. And on my other blog, yeah, did you know that?
No, that,
yeah,
I did not.
I saw your face. And I, in my other blog, Piazza Life, I wrote an article a long time ago called Starbucks Will TKO Italy. I was right. And now Domino's is doing it. You destroy the culture. You destroy everything. They're destroying the family, the culture, the religion. Italy's got nothing left to stand on. In a few years, thousands of years were thrown over. And the kids don't want the burden of 3,000 years of the world's richest history on their shoulders. So they say, screw it. I'm going to have this garbage. It's easier. Pringles, no problem. Domino's, no problem. Anyway, so Pizza and Coffee, I wrote it, and I got known in the world, and because of that, through Slice Serious Eats, where you had great people like Adam Kuban, Ed Levine, Paulie G was so smart, and by the way, your podcast with him was great.
Thank you.
If you talk to him about, you know, mops, I would listen to his accent. I love, he's an American inspiration, that guy, what he managed to do. So, you know, he was on it, and all these people were on it, and that's how I got to meet these people. And then out of nowhere, while that thing came out, in 2008, I stumbled into Una Pizza Napoletana, which back then there's only two Neapolitan places, that and Luzzo's. And I'm waiting outside, and I see these people, and I'm like, they're definitely Italian. And I see it, and it's Rosario Procino and Roberto Caparuccio. And we're looking at each other, whatever. So then they finally open the doors, and we go in. And they sit a few tables away, and I had an Italy jacket on, and we're talking, and I speak Italian, so we're talking. And then they're like, oh, why don't you just come sit with us? So we're talking. Man, my God, I spent like 3 or 4 hours. I don't know. I can't tell you how much time I spent. And Anthony Mangieri was there, and we're talking, whatever. And it was a great time. And they told me, they didn't mention the name or whatever, but they told me what they wanted to do, and I knew it. It's just one of those things you knew. I said, this is going to be the biggest thing ever. I knew it. I'm like, this is going to be the real deal. I felt it, and sure enough, it was. The pizza explosion was thanks to those two people, thanks to Castet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then it
absolutely all
happened. I mean, forget it. With the blogs, people found out about that. That's why social media is good, because people, and now the good thing that you don't have to live in New York and live in this wretched, expensive place. You can go to Florida, Texas, Arizona, and eat Neapolitan pizza, because it's everywhere.
It's all over. It's so global.
It's global, yeah. So those two people changed the game. Anthony Mangieri was he was incredible, and Luzzo's was incredible when Giuseppe Castellano used to make the pizza there. He opened up Tiella, I don't know if you know, 10 years ago. Exceptional.
Okay.
I haven't been in many years, but it's exceptional. And now he's got a place in Boston. But besides that, but to take it on this big thing, it was really them. Because, I mean, America, with the social media, they made it big. And it's thanks to them that it was. And it was the perfect timing for pizza and coffee. And then I said, let me do a thing called Piazza Life. In Italy, the life is lived out in the piazza. I mean, now I know you go there and, they're probably, everyone's not talking to each other and they're probably texting, but the life was lived out in the piazza. So I said, let me do Piazza Life. The photos from a piazza in Salerno. I was at a pizzeria called Trianon, famous pizzeria in Naples that has one in Salerno. And it was a beautiful shot. These kids are playing soccer. I said, let me take a picture. I took a picture, boom. And I decided to do it. And you're on the list of one of the people I wanted to interview, by the way. I just never got around to it because my best friend died and whatever. But It's about bringing people together and share. Yeah, it's Italian based, sure, but so I did that, and I did an interview of the week, and it was going really well. And but you know, it was Italy focused. You know, I would talk about opere o musa, and I would talk about stuff like that. But it's a way for me to just rant about stuff that I care about. But I really get inspired by people like you, who you have been doing this for. I mean, I've known you for, I don't know, I guess like 10 years. But even before that, you were doing radio before that, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I do get inspired by people by you, not just the Castes and the Ribaltas and the you know, Anthony Mangieri and Paulie G, but people like you were doing, because it takes a lot of dedication. A lot of people talk it, but I mean, look at me. Look, I mean, I was out for the count. My best friend died, and then I just gave it up. You've been doing this religiously. You haven't stopped.
I try. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's incredible, and I think it's very important, because at the end of the day, just like I tell people to look into it, to look deeper into the stuff, I think, you know, stuff like what you do is great, because you really delve deeper into something. And how are you going to know the soul of something if you don't delve deep into it?
That's right.
Social media now is just a picture. That doesn't mean anything. That's vacuous to me. That's nothing. That's imagery. It's fake. It's gone. So what do we have? We have the things that bring us together, which is food and family. And you do a great job at showing that, especially with other things that you incorporate into it, with your faith. So thank you for doing that.
I appreciate that. But I think that this is a great segue into my final question I have for you today, Gianluca. I want to talk a little bit about legacy.
Yeah.
What do you want your legacy to be, whether it's the wine shop, whether it's mm-hmm. your stuff with the with your books and stuff like that? Right. So talk a little bit about legacy.
So funny you say that, because I'm having another kid. I have a girl, and I'm having another girl. Well, I'm not having it. My wife is having it. And you know, they're like, oh, but now you're not going to have anyone to pass your last name off to. And honestly, I really don't care about that stuff. And I mean, slightly, but I really don't care. But I want to pass off other things besides my last name. And I hope that everything that made Italy special, I hope I helped contribute to continuing that, so other people will want to pick up on that. Personally, on my personal thing, I don't care. You know, I'm at a point in my life where I fought so hard, and then I realized, what am I fighting so hard? And, you know, this store, I used to think about, what if it closes one day? New York killed its soul. It turned its back on me and on millions of other people. So I have to know, you know, all I have is myself and my family. So that's the legacy I want to leave. For everybody else, I want to leave my legacy as a human being. You know, in vino veritas means in wine there is truth. You know, you get drunk, you tell the truth. The Romans used to have their captives get them drunk so they can tell the truth. And I think that's what's important. What I want people to know for my legacy, you forget the food, forget it all. What it all means, well, my whole point is that I cared so much about the truth that I told the truth in the face of hate, oppression, ignorance, insecurity. And, you know, if I can follow in the greatest footsteps, Jesus Christ said, this is why I was born. I came to bear testimony to the truth. So, hey, if I can do a fraction of that, I think that's a pretty good legacy to leave behind.
Amen. That's a great that's a great way to end this amazing interview. But, Gianluca, before we do close this episode of At the Table with Tony, I want you to give our listeners a little bit about your social media, where they can find you, where your shop is, stuff like that. You know, kind of your social media.
Yeah, so my In Vino Veritas is In Vino Veritas Wines NYC. It's got a picture of Bacchus, because the company name is Bacchus. We DBA, do business as, in Vino Veritas. So you can follow it. You follow me. People can click it on your profile and find it. Facebook, it's also In Vino Veritas. PiazzaLife.com is the blog. I hope I can eventually do it. Pizza and Coffee is my blog, is my website, just a rant. And Wine Made Easy, you can find it Amazon. Very hard to deal with. They have my old link of a book that's out of print that doesn't exist. But my new link, they look differently. The new link, the book came out December 1st, 2019. That's the only one that's available. You should be able to get it within a few days. And that's the only one you should buy. I will be coming out with a second book that I will, if I die right after it, so be it. I'm putting, it's going to be the exact opposite of this book, with the wine book. It's going to be, it won't be the best book of its category, but I think it will be one of the best books, because I'm putting everything I've absorbed from great people.
So that's legacy.
Yes. Yes. It's going to be, I'm going to tie it in. It's going to be, yes, it is legacy. I'm going to tie it in to so many things. And it's a dedication to my family, which, you know, I can't get too deep into it, but in the past few years have been kind of tough, but it's dedicated to a very special person. And then also dedicated to a lot of special people. And I hope It'll be living forever. It'll be the Bible of its category.
Oh, I hope so.
You'll get a copy for sure.
And when it comes out, maybe we'll have to do another. We'll have to talk about it.
Absolutely. I hope you come pick it up because it's going to be a encyclopedic tome. It's going to be like 500 pages.
Hey, that's great. That's awesome. So, again, Gianluca, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to sit down with us and to be able to talk to me here at the table with Tony. Again, I am Anthony Sciglia, better known as Tony Mangia. We are at In Vino Veritas, 1375 First Avenue in New York City, sitting with my friend Gianluca Rotora. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Keep on tuning in. Thank you for everything. Ciao for now.
At the Table with Tony would like to thank its sponsors. Rocco Muriale, Rob Quick, Joseph Cirillo, Raymond Guarini, Tom Gilmore, Oli G, Peter Ziza, Brian McGuire, Peter Ferreira, Rich Ottenstrauer, Anna Mavrianos, Antonio Pepinella, Anthony Ferraro, Sandra and Bob LaMotta, Mike Guero, The Italian Enclaves Historical Society,